This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
And good afternoon. This is Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins again. I'm honored to do so. Tony's on vacation, taking a break, or he's out working on the road. I'm not too sure which, but I'm honored to sit in for him this afternoon. Again, my name is Dr. Everett Piper. I'm the president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. It's a pleasure to join you this afternoon. Let's take care of some laundry right now, some business to set the stage for the next hour. If you want to call in, the number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. Just to set the stage for what we're going to do in the next hour, these are some topics that I'm going to try to hit. The first one is, do we have the right to give away our religious freedom? Is it ours to give away? I've had many within this election season suggest that as principled conservatives, as principled Christians, they're going to give their religious freedom away. They're willing to lose their religious freedom rather than vote for either one of the two primary candidates. Do we have the right to give that away? Is it ours to give away in the first place, that religious freedom? That's topic number one. Topic number two, what's the Christian's duty to engage in what I'm going to call triage in this time of cultural war and culture debate? The social and moral battles before us. Do we have a responsibility, a duty to engage in triage? And on that topic, we're going to have General Boykin join us at the 5:30 break, the 5:32 break to be exact, and we're going to talk about that issue. Another issue I'd like to talk about is God's sovereignty and human responsibility during a time of persecution. How are we to act in the midst of believing in a sovereign God, but yet also, I assume, believing that as Christians, born-again believers in Jesus Christ, that we also have human culpability and responsibility to lead and to fight and to charge into the storm, if you will, rather than just hunker down and say, a pox on all your houses, let God be your judge. And then I'd like to talk about a couple other issues if we have time. Belgium just announced its euthanasia program for the mentally ill. And over the past year, they've actually euthanized well over 30 mentally ill people, those with Alzheimer's and dementia, those that are autistic, those that have schizophrenia, and others have been euthanized. They've been killed. They've been murdered. They've been executed within the country of Belgium and the Netherlands. We'll talk about that. How about the selective outrage of the left with regard to Donald Trump's vulgarity? I wrote an op-ed recently on that. In fact, I'm going to close out this particular segment in a couple minutes by reading that op-ed, and it's titled, Why the Selective Outrage from the Left? How about the hypocrisy of the NCAA and the NAIA, the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, pulling out of North Carolina. I run a university that's a member of the NAIA, the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, that claims the motto of an organization of character. Character is the motto of the NAIA, and they broke their contract with the state of North Carolina because, crazy as it sounds, the people in North Carolina think that females should have the right to their own bathroom and that women should have the right to their own sports. The state of North Carolina actually believes in science and believes in the biological fact of the female, and that women should have their own sport, their own shower, their own privacy, and have their own restrooms. And apparently that's distasteful to the NCAA and the NAIA, and they pulled out. We can talk about that. How about the censoring of conservative ideas? YouTube has announced that it is censoring Dennis Prager's Prager University. If you don't know who Dennis Prager is, we'll talk about that a little bit. They're censoring his videos, his commentary. They've taken 21 of those 5-minute videos and they put them on the restricted list. They've censored them, so it's very difficult, if not impossible, for you and I or anybody else to watch those videos now. We'll talk about the titles and the topics of those videos and YouTube's censoring of them. And then parallel to that, the ongoing academic censoring of conservative ideas. I think I talked in a previous program about Sally Cohn, the MSNBC, CNN commentator who said that she was glad that conservative ideas were being excluded from the academy. And she was happy that people such as yours truly, who's arguing for academic freedom and intellectual liberty rather than being willing to buy into this ideological fascism that's playing out on the college campus today. She actually said in a debate at the University of Missouri, in a symposium at the University of Missouri, that she was happy and she was glad that voices such as mine and probably yours are being excluded from the academy today. So those are some of the topics that I'd like to talk about. Before I get into reading this op-ed that I want to share with you titled Why the Selective Outrage, I'd like to remind you about what Wesleyan stands for. Perhaps this is shameless self-promotion, but I really don't think so, because I really believe, folks, I really believe that we need to remember that ideas have consequences. Ideas have great power. One of the most powerful things in culture, one of the most powerful things for the human being, is the power of words, the power of ideas, the power that ideas have to change culture, to craft agendas, to identify the agenda. Ideas have consequences. Richard Weaver told us in 1948 that ideas have consequences. Work. And what was his point? Ideas matter. They have consequences. They always lead somewhere. Good ideas will bear good fruit, good culture, good church, and good community. And bad ideas will bear bad fruit, bad culture, bad community, and bad government. And the ideological carcinogens, if you will, that we are consuming as a culture, those bad ideas, those ideas that breed cancer of the mind and cancer of the soul that we're feeding our youngest, feeding our children in elementary school and in high school and then in colleges, those ideas are coming home to roost right now, and that's why we're having these consequences and these conversations that seem to be almost unbelievable for us. We can't believe the world is this upside down. Well, folks, the reason that you're seeing this is the chickens are coming home to roost. You've been sending your kids off to institutions that have been teaching this pablum for several decades, and why in the world are you surprised to see your kids return home, return to the courthouse, return to the courtroom, return to the church, return to your living room on Thanksgiving break and Christmas break, expressing these terrible ideas and believing them and embracing them, and then therefore suffering the cancer of the soul that comes with consuming those terrible ideas. We've got to take ideas seriously. And I'm lobbying right now. I'm pleading with you to stop spending 18 years of your life training up your children in the way they should go so that when they are old, they will not depart. And then in the first 18 minutes as you drop them off at a college campus and you drive away smiling and proud of them, in those 18 minutes, they're already working to tear the heart and mind and soul out of your kids and telling them that your ideas, your Judeo-Christian ideas, your biblical worldview is distasteful and it's naive and it's a lie. Why would you pay $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 on the barrelhead to have that happen to your kids? I don't understand it. At Oklahoma Wesleyan, we believe in the primacy of Jesus Christ, the priority of Scripture, and the pursuit of truth and the practice of wisdom. We believe that Jesus is the Son of God, the Bible is the Word of God, that truth is given by God, and that wisdom, holiness, and sanctification, obedience is demanded by God, and we should do no other. We teach that in every classroom, in every chapel, in the cafeteria, and on the court. And if I gave your kids nothing but that, you'd be getting your money's worth. But in addition to that, you get U.S. News and World Report and Forbes.com and regional best this and regional best that. You get excellent academics. But the problem is other institutions that brag of their great academics are frankly lying, because if academic life isn't grounded in the truth of Christ and truth of Scripture, you're wasting your time and your money. And you're going to see your offspring, your sons, your daughters return with ideas that are antithetical to the truth of Scripture, to the biblical worldview that you work so hard to instill in them. Take the ideas seriously that you're teaching the next generation. Consider the education that you're giving those kids. Consider a biblical education and accept no other. I'd like to talk to you a little bit right now about this selective outrage of the left. I'm going to read this article to you. Let's cut to the chase. I've been very clear in my previous writing regarding how I feel about the current GOP presidential candidate. So please don't even try to suggest I'm not standing consistently and clearly for Christian virtue. Such a challenge simply won't hold water. With that caveat aside, I simply must say it. The hypocrisy and the two-faced duplicity of the progressive left concerning Donald Trump is frankly embarrassingly dishonest, intellectually shallow, and morally vacuous. Where was their outrage when Bill Clinton used women for recreation and made and a blue-stained dress part of our national dinner conversation? Where was the outrage of the left when Hillary Clinton called these women, whom her husband was using as playthings, some trash? And where was their outrage when Hollywood and the Washington Beltway mocked the prudishness of those like me who dared suggest a leader's private life is indeed our business, and any politician who would use women privately and then lie about it should be held accountable publicly? Where was their outrage when Sports Illustrated decided decades ago to make women the object of recreation on its annual swimsuit edition? Where was their outrage the last time they walked by the countless newsstands flaunting the commodification of women on cover after cover after cover of nearly every magazine displayed? Where was their outrage when they clicked on their favorite website only to find it saturated with links blatantly using the female body to sell everything from cars and beer to shoes and fast food? Where was their outrage when they last shopped at Abercrombie & Fitch or Victoria's Secret or any host of other retailers who profit in pornography? Where was their outrage when women in North Carolina were insulted time and time again by misogynistic politicians and other delusional demagogues who pretend that a female is not a biological fact, but rather the fabrication of a dysphoric male who wants to steal a woman's identity and even take away her right to her own bathroom? Where was their outrage when President Obama honored rappers and other media elites at the White House who have made their millions degrading women and treating them as objects to be used as sexual chattel? Where was their outrage when the Supreme Court said that traditional morality doesn't matter anymore and that they, the smart ones, the brights, the elites, those who have declared themselves to be as God, would now tell all the rest of us what is right and wrong, and that anyone who is still mired in the old morality of good and bad sex should be sequestered and even sentenced to silence? Where were they when these same judges decided that the entire nation that marriage is no longer an institution that preserves the dignity of women, but instead is now little more than a celebration of every imaginable sexual act the male libido can contrive? Where were they? Where was their outrage? Where was the outrage of the left when all of this took place? You know, Dr. Ben Carson recently tweeted, "How did 50 Shades of Grey sell a gazillion copies of if women are so outraged?" And his question is painful, but it is appropriate. How can a culture that dishonors women to the tune of buying 80 million copies of a book that celebrates their sexual bondage pretend to be alarmed by a man who just said exactly what many have so eagerly indulged for decades? The hypocrisy is thick, and the duplicity is shameful. The duplicity of the left is shameful. Now, none of anything I just said exonerates anything that the Republican candidate has said or done in his life, but the consistency of a moral critique is important, and I'm glad the left finally says there's such a thing as sexual morality. What I'd like to ask them now is this: where in the world did it come from? I'm glad you're interested in it. Where did it come from, and who defines it? Because your definition isn't working. This is Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. Again, the call-in number is 866-372-7234. We're going to take a commercial break right now and be back in a minute.
This November, faith, family, and freedom are on the ballot. After 8 years of President Obama, this election will mark the beginning of a new chapter in America. With hundreds of federal races and thousands of state and local contests, the results will determine the future of pro-life legislation, our ability to freely live out our religious beliefs, and who our next Supreme Court justices will be. That's why FRC Action is mounting the National Values Voter Bus Tour. Our bus tour is traveling the country and working with national and state groups to equip and mobilize values voters in battleground states and key races across the nation. As it travels the country, the values bus could be coming to a city near you. Join us in the effort for your values, your vote, your future. Visit valuesbustour.org for more information and to find a stop near you. That is valuesbustour.org. Hope to see you soon.
Are you concerned about the future? The AFA Foundation can help. End-of-year giving allows you to offset your current taxable income, providing you with valuable tax savings on this year's return. And your generous gift will help further the mission of AFA to inform, equip, and motivate people in the culture war for years to come. Through the AFA Foundation, you're supporting the work of the American Family Association by helping individuals and families leave a legacy to help stem the tide of secularism and rebuild our Christian foundations. As the end of the year approaches, carefully considering what to give and when to give it can increase the impact of your gift while still meeting your own needs as well. For example, with a cash donation, your itemized tax return may allow you to receive up to the full value of your charitable gift. Contact the AFA Foundation through Facebook, at our website, afafoundation.net, or call 800-326-4543, extension 345.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. Two similar articles written by conservative young women in the past week make a point that's worth an extended look. Gracie Olmsted notes at TheFederalist.com, politicians sell us a false gospel. They tell us that if only we elect the right candidate, all our problems will be solved. Liberty McCarter at TheStream.org echoes Gracie's premise and makes this appeal to her own generation, quoting, "No candidate, no matter how good, can adequately address it all. That's because solving such problems will be the work of a generation of everyday people, not a president who sits in the Oval Office for 4 or 8 years," unquote. When you step out of the polling booth next month, you'll still be surrounded by broken people who need the love of Christ. Only when God's church begins to fulfill its purpose in the world will we see change happen. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
Dr. Everett Piper, sitting in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch this afternoon. I think I have a caller or two. I'm going to take the first caller, and then I want to give myself enough time to cover the next topic and set it up for General Boykin, who will be joining us after the 5:30 break. Harry in North Carolina, I believe you're on the line.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to call listening to your program, and I just wanted to just commend you and say I appreciate what I heard. I was a public school teacher for 9 to 10 years in the public school education department in South Carolina, and then for a brief time in North Carolina, and I'm out of it now. But while I was there, as a professed Christian, I saw things that just shouldn't have been there, things that my parents didn't have to deal with in the public school system. And it was disheartening. Because as a public school teacher, you can't share your faith with the students. I mean, that's a horrible thing. You can tell them about other stuff, but, I mean, you know, you can't do that. And it's full of secular humanism. And to make a long story short, I love young people, and I want to give back in a positive way, but I've come to learn to hate the public school system. And it's unfortunate because I'm out of it now. I got out of it, and I'm doing something else just to raise my family. But I just wanted to, say that I had agreed with some of the things that you're saying about the demoralization of the left, and I don't know if they've taken over the system as far as public education is concerned. But it's a shame that it's just changed so much.
Thank you, Harry. I appreciate you calling in. I appreciate your heart and your passion for kids and your passion to teach them what's right and just and true and beautiful. We need to remember the power of the biblical idea, the power of the Christian idea, the power of God's truth. And I think one of the great mistakes we've made in the public schools and in the public square is we have allowed ourselves to be intimidated into silence. We do have rights. We do have the protection of the First Amendment. We do have the protection of the Constitution. And we need to stop being intimidated into silence by the left, who wants to suggest that those rights have somehow changed and that the Constitution has been amended. It has not. I think it's time for us to challenge those forces in our culture that are attempting to silence us, to censor us, to sequester us, to get us to just be quiet and sit in the back of the bus, if you will. It's time to, for us to step forward and say why. It's time to, for us to argue for classical liberalism, if you will. I wrote a book a couple years ago, and it's titled Why I'm a Liberal and Other Conservative Ideas. Now stop and think about what I just said. Why I'm a Liberal and Other Conservative Ideas. Now, why would this conservative college president that's talking to you right now identify himself as a liberal? It's because classical liberalism stands for liberty and liberation and freedom and justice. The Liberal Arts Academy, as I've said earlier on this program in previous episodes, was established, let's say, in Oxford in 1100 AD to educate a free man and a free woman, a free culture and a free society, a free government, a free people. Liberal meant liberty. Liberal meant liberation. It meant freedom, and we need to recover the high ground of the words that have been co-opted and stolen from us, the power of ideas. And we need to have confidence and courage as we enter into the courthouse and the public square and into the schoolhouse, and unfortunately even into some of our churches today, and proclaim those objective truths, those time-tested truths that no man can change. That's good education. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's the only context for freedom. As I get ready to transition, and I've only got a couple minutes to do it here, I want to ask you this. Do you have the right to lose your religious freedom just because you don't want to vote? Do you have the right to give away that freedom? I was recently having a debate here on our campus with somebody who said, and great scholar, biblically sound, very faithful biblical scholar, he suggested that he'd rather lose his religious freedom than vote for either one of the two candidates. And my response was this: is it yours to lose? Is it yours to give away? Is religious freedom owned by the individual, or is it owned by the corporate community? Is religious freedom owned by one man, or is it owned by mankind? I would suggest that religious freedom is not yours to give away. Religious freedom is not mine to give away. Religious freedom is owned by the community. It's owned by the country. It's owned and defined by the culture, by the Constitution. I have no more right to give away religious freedom than I have the right to give away the road that leads up to the front of your house. It's not mine. It's not yours. It's ours, and I can't give away something that I don't own. Many people have fought and died to give us that corporately owned blessing, that gift of religious freedom. And I don't think we can so cavalierly step away from it and say, well, I'd be glad to use it. I'd be glad, excuse me, to lose it. I'd be glad to give it away because, out of principle, I refuse to get pragmatic and get my hands dirty by voting in this election. That's not an endorsement of anybody. What it is, it's an argument for religious freedom. And what I'd like to also ask is this. In the midst of the cultural debate, do we have anything to learn from the analogy of triage on the field of battle? As you well know, an army surgeon has the responsibility to make very difficult decisions in the heat of war. He sees these soldiers coming in bloodied and battered, and he knows that he has to make the tough choice of triage, because if he doesn't, many, if not all, will die. But if he makes the difficult, the ugly, the bloody and dirty choice of triage, at least some will live. Is that an analogy that's appropriate for the political debate today? Can we afford to just wash our hands as surgeons, if you will, of the battle, of the carnage, throw our hands up in the air and say, I refuse to make a decision. I refuse to get involved. Let God decide who wins. Let God decide who lives and who dies. And in the face of an election where we know that one candidate has promised us she will continue to double down and kill millions and millions of our youngest via abortion, can we wash our hands of that, or do we have an obligation of triage to try to save a few lives, like Oscar Schindler did? I could just save one more. This is Dr. Everett Piper with Oklahoma Wesleyan University sitting in on Washington Watch for Tony Perkins this afternoon. Coming up after the break, General Boykin will respond to my analogy of triage and tell me whether it makes any sense or not. Be right back after these commercials.
most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Do I really want to manage my own portfolio? It's a great question, and it's one that we should be thinking about before we get into doing that. As you all know, I'm very concerned about all of us being biblically responsible, doing what is right with the money God has entrusted us, making sure that we're not investing because when we invest, we are taking ownership in companies, making sure that they are biblically responsible companies. In other words, they aren't involved in pornography or abortion or things that would be offensive to God. This is God's money. He has entrusted us to be a good steward of it, and we need to make sure we do that. So if you don't have the time to do the work in managing individual stocks, the best way to do that is mutual funds. But the only mutual funds you can use are the Timothy plans. They're the only true biblically responsible mutual fund company. They are evenly yoked with you and I and desire to make sure that the money that they're managing is being invested in things that are biblically responsible, that are honoring and would be pleasing to God. So if you're going to do the mutual fund route, the only way to do it is with Timothy Plan, timothyplan.com. Not because it is just easier, which it is, but because it's biblically responsible and it's the right thing to do in the eyes of God.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
This is Dr. Everett Piper again, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon on Washington Watch. And I have the privilege of having General Jerry Boykin joining me. I feel a little presumptuous even saying that, General. I don't feel as if you are joining me. I'm joining you. This is your show. General, are you there?
I am here, and I'm glad to be with you, Dr. Piper.
Well, thanks for tag-teaming with me at the break here. I really appreciate it. Now, I was setting this up before we took the commercial break, and I have used the analogy of triage and how the Army surgeon is obligated to be pragmatic in the face of battle. It's ugly, it's dirty, it's messy, it's less than ideal, but soldiers are being dragged in from the front lines, and the surgeon has to make tough choices. And if he refuses to make those choices, if he washes his hands of the situation and idealistically says, I can't decide, God should decide who lives or who dies in this circumstance, then frankly, everybody's going to die because he refused to dirty his hands and do the pragmatic work of triage, if you will, to at least save some lives rather than let all of those die. And I use that as an analogy for where we are in this election right now, and frankly, as a very, very strong pro-life advocate, as I'm sure you are, and as the Family Research Council is, when we see the promise of one candidate to continue to double down and in the pursuit of millions and millions of deaths of our youngest via abortion, then do we have the responsibility as Christian voters to get involved in triage and at least save some of them? General, am I on task here? What do you think of this analogy?
Yeah, you know, Dr. Piper, I've been wounded twice, and once was very severely. I do not want a surgeon like that on the battlefield. I don't want a triage doctor on the battlefield that can't recognize that he has a responsibility there to save as many as possible. You know, there's a category of casualty that's called expectant, which means this casualty is going to die no matter what I do. And the surgeon makes a tough decision to go and use all his resources and skills to try and save those that he can save. And I think you're right on with this. You know, the statement that Donald Trump made the other night about abortion, particularly partial birth abortion, was the boldest statement that a Republican candidate or even a Democratic candidate certainly has made in probably in the history of American politics. It was a bold and very clear statement of where he stood on the issue of saving babies.
Well, and somebody You know, because, General, I've been critical of Donald Trump before. During the primaries, I wrote an article that Fox picked up and basically criticized Jerry Falwell Jr. and others for endorsing Trump at the time. So people are going to say, well, Piper's flipped or General Boykin has flipped. They're now endorsing Trump. And my response to that is I'm not endorsing anything but life. I'm endorsing the life of those that will die if we don't get involved and perform our Christian duty in the heat of battle, in the midst of slavery and oppression and murder, in the face of the killing fields and the Holocaust of our time. If we don't get involved and pragmatically act as army surgeons and perform the dirty work of triage, we know that everybody's going to die. I'm endorsing life. That's what I think I'm responsible for as a Christian soldier, if you will, and a Christian voter.
I totally agree with you. Look, I actually campaigned with Ted Cruz. I traveled with him. I campaigned with him. He was my choice. But if you look at this year's committee platform for the Republican Party, and compare it to the Democratic platform, what you will see is that it is the most pro-life, and it's actually the most conservative platform that the Republican Party has had in the last 50 years. This is a totally pro-life platform. Now, I'm supporting that platform. I'm voting for that platform because, like you, I do not want to see any more babies killed in the womb, and as it was so graphically described, pulled partway out of the womb and killed in what I consider to be a barbaric manner.
And how dare we, I said this to somebody who was debating with me earlier, how dare we claim the high ground, quote unquote, and walk into eternity and look millions of babies in the face and say, I just didn't want to dirty my hands in war. I didn't want to dirty my hands in battle. Your life wasn't important enough for me. I took the principled high ground. I wasn't pragmatic enough to try to save a few. It just seems...
Well, yeah, I agree with you. Dr. Piper, if you had a brain tumor that required a very delicate surgery and the best surgeon in the world to save your life was an atheist or had a girlfriend or a mistress or had a lifestyle that you didn't agree with, would you turn that guy down if he could save your life? I wouldn't. I would rely on his skills as a doctor, not on his personal life or his personal faith. Now, I'd prefer a Christian doctor at any time. But in that kind of situation, we need to be thinking in terms of what's at stake here. What's at stake here is not only the lives of these babies, but it's your right and my right to come on this radio program and talk about our beliefs and our values. And that is going to be under attack as well.
General, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to help me out with this. I appreciate your commentary. I appreciate your leadership and your service to our country. This is Dr. Everett Piper, sitting in for Tony and tag teaming with the general. We're going to take a break right now, and I'll be back in a couple minutes.
One of the more emotional times on our tour of Israel is when we go to the house of Caiaphas. This is where Jesus Christ was held the night before his appearance before Pilate. And we see the dungeon where he was held. And it's just a very striking thing to be there knowing our Lord suffered in this way and was treated in this way. That's one of the places we'll visit is the house of Caiaphas, where the trial took place as well. Well, for more information on our tour of Israel and all the places we'll see and all the places we'll go, it's going to be a wonderful time with brothers and sisters from around the country. Our phone number is 800-FAMILIES, 800-FAMILIES, F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S, 1-800-FAMILIES, option 5 for more information. Or if you want to go on the internet, twholyland.com. Go to the website twholyland.com. Come see the Land of the Bible with us in March.
Dave?
Over here, John. Thanks for meeting me like this.
What are we doing in here?
Well, you're one of the only people I know who shares my Christian beliefs. And this is the only place I know we won't offend anyone.
Don't cave to the pressures of society. Stand. Blog and share your thoughts on subjects that matter. See what others are saying and join the discussion at The Stand. Visit afa.net/The Stand.
Consider serving the Lord with friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Hi, this is Steve Tiber, president, co-founder of 8 Days of Hope. 8 Days of Hope was meant to be a one-time trip to Bay St. Louis, Waveland, Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina. And then God got involved. And since then, we have been to 9 different states, rebuilt 1,700 homes, and it's all because we love Jesus. God tells us to love Him and love others. And that's what we do, either through 8 Days of Hope or a new ministry called Hope Reigns. Hope Reigns goes immediately after disaster, a tornado, a flood, a fire, a snowstorm. But what we notice with disasters is right after disaster, there's so many ministry opportunities. We've already been to New York, Illinois, Tennessee, Texas. So if someone's interested in 8 Days of Hope or Hope Reigns, the best place to go is our website, 8daysofhope.com. And even though we might not have an event planned the day you go to the website, if you give us your email address on our website, we'll be able to contact you about future events.
Again, welcome back this afternoon to Washington Watch. This is Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. I want to summarize what the general and I just discussed in the previous segment before I take 2 calls. I do have 2 waiting for me right now, so don't hang up, Linda, and don't hang up, Emma. I am going to take your call. But I want to summarize what the general and I just said and then proceed with those, with the dialogue with the 2 callers. Here's my point. When at war, what are we supposed to do? In the midst of the carnage, are we not obligated to save as many lives as we can? Isn't the army surgeon obligated to save as many lives as he can? Isn't the medic obligated to go out onto the battlefield, out to the front line, and drag as many casualties in as he can? Is that a pragmatic argument? Perhaps. But aren't we obligated to count the costs and to make the hard decisions to save the greater number when in the heat of battle? I think of Oscar Schindler in Schindler's List as he wept, convicted that he could have done more. Should we not have the same desire to save every single soul we can, to rescue, if you will, one more person, quote-unquote, to quote Schindler, every single human being we can from death, and from bondage and slavery and from sin? This is not an endorsement of Trump. It's an endorsement of life. It's an endorsement for Christian duty in the heat of battle, in the midst of slavery and oppression and murder, in the face of the killing fields and the Holocaust of our time. So many are claiming that we should essentially disengage and wash our hands of this mess on the basis of principle. But in the days ahead, is that really what the follower of Christ is to do? With sin so rampant on both sides, are we to say, a pox on all your houses, let God be your judge, knowing that more will die and more will be enslaved because we refused and we were just principled rather than pragmatic? Isn't it the doctor's duty to be pragmatic because of the higher principle of life in the ugly business of triage? Should he ever say, let them all die on the basis of a principle? I cannot decide who should live. Let God decide. I won't get involved. Is that what the doctor should do? My concern right now is that the conservative seems to be leaning more toward the disengaged doctor than the weeping and conflicted Schindler. And I'm not convinced this is our Christian duty. Linda in Indiana, are you there?
I'm here. I so appreciate just what you said. I've listened to you before, and I said, oh, man, I wish my grandchildren could have gone to Oklahoma Wesleyan University.
But well, thank you.
I have a couple comments. I'm a 77-year-old grandma and been Christian all my life. But I wanted to tell you, I was fortunate enough to got to see Dr. Ben Carson in person and listen to his message. And the first of this month, I went to Indianapolis to hear Dr. Franklin Graham.
Yes.
And so I was so moved when I got home. I wrote an article in our local paper and told them how we as Christians need to vote and do our patriotic duty. So I got a call last night from a lady that said she was not going to vote until she read my article. So Dr. Graham, he keeps telling everybody to stand up for the Christian values. And so I just wanted to pass that on.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you. And it's great advice. It's simple, it's clear, and it's good advice. Again, I'm going to repeat myself, and I think I'm saying what Linda just challenged us with, and that is we have an obligation to engage. It's not the Christian's prerogative to disengage. Chuck Colson was a mentor of mine, and he told us over and over again that our obligation was to engage the public square with the truth of Christ and truth of Scripture. And you may say, but both of these candidates are sinful pagans. Grant you that. But what are the higher principles? As General Boykin pointed out, what are the higher principles in play here? The highest is human life and our obligation to defend it. Our obligation to defend it and rescue as many from the field of battle as possible. That's the highest obligation, the highest principle. And remember what Osgenis taught me while I was in Oxford studying earlier this summer. You always vote for a covenant. You never vote for a hierarchy. Covenants, constitutions, always lend themselves to freedom. Hierarchies, government bureaucracies, government-led ideas, the hierarchy's always been toward power and control. Oz said, if you want human freedom, Everett, you always vote for the covenant, its principles. Presidents come and presidents go, but principles and covenants endure. Vote for the covenant, not a king. We don't have kings in the United States. At least we shouldn't. We have covenants, and those covenants are what we should hold our elected officials to honor. That's our job once they're elected. Emma in Virginia, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I want to just set the background that I am a former military spouse of 10 years. I have two brothers that are medical physicians, and my daughter is a senior at Liberty University, and we love Jerry Falwell Jr. And I just want to say that I've been so disappointed that even with the points that you are making that are absolutely correct about the soldier and the surgeon, others in our society that hold these positions of authority and are in positions to make decisions that will affect so many. When we go to the emergency room, sir, we don't stop to ask whether this person is liberal or conservative, whether he uses bad language. We don't question that in that moment. But we need someone like Donald Trump who is unafraid to confront, if he has displayed himself to be able to confront the hard issues. But what saddens me the most is, as a Christian, I'm more concerned with the salvation of Donald Trump more than the salvation of this nation. And I say that sincerely. We have seen a man surrounded by so many credible Christian leaders. Does somebody not think that God is moving in that situation? I'm just really disappointed that we are criticizing our brothers and sisters in Christ who have supported him even from the beginning, and we are not more united in remembering the Great Commission, not just all the many that we're interested in saving, as such as the lives of the unborn, but God cares about Donald Trump as well.
His
Fair enough. Salvation is of the utmost importance, and for us to judge him whether he has accepted Christ or not, and so many witnesses have said that he has in fact accepted Jesus Christ, who are we to expect that he'd be less of a sinner than we ourselves are?
Fair enough, Emma. Good points. I think it's very fair, and we all know that this debate is running rampant through the Christian community. It started during the primary season, and it continues to this very point. I think, Emma and others listening right now, the truth of the matter, the fact of the matter is, many of us rightfully challenged Bill Clinton when his immorality came into play and his dishonesty came into play, and it compromised the country. Now, if some are listening and saying, well, his private life didn't compromise the country, I would beg to differ. Private life and public life in the mind of the Christian, in the mind of a life of integrity, are always integrated. In fact, the word integrity implies integration. You can't separate head from heart, fact from faith, belief from behavior, or private life from public life. As Christians, we believe that. We believe in living a life of integrity and practicing what we preach, if you will. And when we see a politician that doesn't do that, I do think we've got an obligation, not out of self-righteousness, but out of concern for character, for what's being taught to the country and what's being taught to our kids, to expect our leaders to lead with integrity. And I don't think we should apologize for calling people out on that. However, we shouldn't be self-righteous and acting as if we somehow are without sin, and therefore we're going to throw stones as Pharisees. Obviously, that's contradictory to Christianity, the teachings of Christ, and the Bible. The conflict right now is we're having to deal with this fact that Donald Trump has used language that's vulgar. He's boasted of behaviors that we all disagree with. Has he changed? We don't know. But this one thing we do know is that Hillary Clinton promises us what she will do, and her solutions involve the murder of millions of our youngest citizens, babies that are preborn, even partially born, and many in Hillary's circle are even arguing for post-birth abortion because they're not viable yet even after birth. This is deplorable. We have a man who may be a pagan, may not be, has been vulgar, does have some moral history that we desperately disagree with, who yet comes forward and challenges Clinton and says, that's wrong. I will defend those lives. I will not take them. To me, that is the biggest issue of the election season. As I said, I don't have to endorse any particular candidate to stand forthrightly and say, I endorse life and I will vote accordingly for the ideas, for the principles, for the virtues, for the veritas, the truth, with a capital T, of God defining life, not government, not you, not me, but God. That's what's in play right now. And one of the things I'd like to point out as we get ready to sail into the last couple minutes here is how important this discussion is. How important placing the priorities in the right place as we decide how to vote. The euthanasia issue that's taking place right now in Belgium is amazing. If you haven't read this story, you need to go to the Washington Post, not a conservative right-wing bastion, by the way, the Washington Post opinion section, which just wrote of the morality crisis of euthanasia in Belgium. This is explicitly going on. It is not hypothetical. This is a fact. There's a Belgian medical system that over the past 2 years has administered lethal injections upon the request of 5 non-terminally ill people with schizophrenia, 5 with autism, 8 with bipolar disorder, and 29 with dementia, i.e. Alzheimer's. This has taken place over the last 2 years, and an additional 39 have been euthanized with depression. This is not make-believe. This is not hypothetical. This is not right-wing propaganda. This is the Washington Post reporting it. This Belgian authority, this panel, defends this action by saying that there's a one-month waiting period required between the time that a mentally ill person signs his name on the dotted line giving permission and a request to be euthanized. And they say that this is the way they find the true will, quote-unquote, of the patient, and they honor it. Now, excuse me. If we're talking about mentally ill people with dementia, autism, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, how in the world can we trust their signature on a document that says they want to be executed? They want to be euthanized. But this Belgian committee is using that as their excuse to perpetuate the elimination, the execution, the euthanizing of the mentally ill. This is on our doorstep. This is happening in Belgium. It's happening in the Netherlands. and what we're discussing right now in the United States in terms of partial birth abortion, the dumbing down of the human being to nothing but bioplasm and biological mass, and that it is nothing to, there's nothing to differentiate it from a tumor until it's born. This dumbing down of the human being to something that is defined by us rather than defined by God is going to bear fruit. Ideas have consequences. I said this earlier. A bad idea bears bad fruit. And the bad idea of us deciding how to define life rather than giving God the authority and allowing God to define who, what is human, the imago Dei, that arrogance on our part, that hubris on our part, that committing of the original sin over and over again where we say, we will be as gods, and we don't need God to define anything any longer. We don't need him to define right or wrong, good or evil. We don't need him to define what is true and what is false. We don't need him to define what is male and what is female, and we certainly don't need God to define what the human is any longer. When we rise up to be as gods, it won't be abortion. It won't be partial birth abortion. It'll be post-birth abortion. It'll be euthanasia that will be discussed next. And if you think that's hyperbolic, if you think that's an exaggeration, if you think that I'm on some sort of right-wing rant, then go read the Washington Post, because right now that's what they're discussing there. The fact that in Belgium they are terminating mentally ill people by the dozens simply because someone else decided that they weren't worthy of life. It's frightening. I'd like to close with this, or perhaps close with this. We'll see how much time we have left here. The debate within the Christian community in some sectors right now is, God is sovereign. Let him do his will on America. We deserve judgment. He is sovereign. We need to rest in that sovereignty. Well, I agree. God is sovereign. I assume you agree that God is sovereign. But while God is sovereign, and we do know that all things mysteriously work together for the good of those that love the Lord, we also should not cavalierly invite his judgment, in my view. And we shouldn't just simplistically dismiss the terrible toll that persecution plays on those who suffer at the hand of evil. You know, if we just said, well, God is sovereign, let him judge America, what would we have done? If we lived in the days of slavery, would we have had such an attitude during the days of slavery? And if we did, we would not have worked for its abolition. We would have just said, let God be sovereign, let him judge. We would not have taken a stand as Orrin Scott, the founder of the Wesleyan Church, took a stand and said, no, a black man is a human being. We would not have stood with William Wilberforce and said, with all of the African Americans that were enslaved in Great Britain, are we not men? The fact of the matter is, with God's sovereignty, we also have the responsibility of behaving and acting as Christians. God reigns, but we are told to fight against the principalities and powers and to resist the ravages of the devil at every turn. To do less would be to abdicate our duty. We are obligated to be loyal and obedient soldiers in the battle for justice as we walk humbly with our God. This is Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, honored to be with you this afternoon on Washington Watch. I'm sure Tony Perkins will be back perhaps sometimes next week. I actually will be joining you again on Monday. Blessings for the weekend.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.